is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Well, welcome to another interesting Viewpoint This Sunday, where we continue to bring you topics directly related to and affecting the state of America, our national security, and American culture. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli, forensic criminologist, law enforcement and crime expert, and co-host of Talking While Married on America Out Loud. And it's my pleasure to be sitting in for our fearless leader, Malcolm Out Loud. Joining me for our first segment today on our nation's current immigration crisis and fiasco is a guest who is fluent on issues and policies affecting immigration, Michael Johns. Michael is a national co-founder and leader of the original U.S. Tea Party movement and a former White House speechwriter and Heritage Foundation policy analyst. In 2014, Michael was the first to draw national attention to the case of 18-year-old Josh Wilkerson of McAllen, Texas, who was brutally murdered by an illegal alien from Central America. Michael, let's get right into this. I know you're fluent in these issues, and I'm in Texas and right at ground zero where the immigration...
You sure are.
Tell you what. What is going on after this wonderful respite from former President Donald J. Trump, and now things are absolutely out of control?
Firstly, great to be with you, Ron. I've been greatly appreciative of all your work over the years and your good contributions to America Out Loud and wonderful shows, including with Linda. We're talking with Mary. Great show. The issue is essentially one of great contrast. I mean, when you look at President Trump's election in 2016, there were many contributing factors. I've often described it as kind of the roar of the forgotten man and woman of the United States. But immigration, both legal and illegal, was central to that.
And a recognition, I think, by the American people that this issue has been essentially ignored by both parties for decades. You go through these 4 years, President Trump made a considerable degree of progress on the issue, on both of them, legal and illegal. Clearly, neither of them were completely resolved. I think that more likely would have taken a second term or even subsequent presidents, but progress was considerable. And Biden really, in these first 6 weeks of his presidency, have essentially sought to roll back just about anything that's had Trump affiliated with it. That, of course, has included all of these constructive steps, most prominently in court, including some progress on this border wall construction, roughly 700 miles of it, of which was built on a 2,800 mile border, and an enormous number of other executive orders, all of which are designed to increase the flow of immigrants into the United States without almost any regard as to who these people are or what contributing factor warrants them coming here. And we're doing this all, of course, in a moment when we're facing a pandemic. These illegal immigrants aren't even being tested, though so far, in sample populations, they've gotten about a 10% positive rate, while the rest of the country is largely locked down and there's mask mandates and all sorts of constraining regulations. And also, importantly, at a time when we've got millions of Americans out of the labor force looking to get back in, and sort of economics 101 is, if you want to create jobs, growing the labor pool, those who are available and interested in working but don't have jobs, makes it more, not less, difficult for them to obtain it. And of course, I guess most frustrating to the Americans who've looked closely at it is that none of this is coincidental or accidental. It's been a long-term design, probably of both parties, but certainly of the modern Democrat Party, to deflate wages in this country to increase public welfare dependency and ultimately, in their view, expand what they think is going to be a political constituency, which, when afforded citizenship at some future point, which couldn't come fast enough for them, would be loyal to them as a political party. That, in essence,
Michael, you know, one of the things, Michael, that really bothers me on a certain level is the type of people that we are bringing into this country, because we're bringing in people from Guatemala, from Honduras, from Central America, from Mexico, and these are the lowest of the educated people. They are the lowest of the level of labor, another, the lowest skill set, the lowest language assimilation, and they're going to come into this country, and what are they going to do? How are they going to flood the labor force and look at the billions and billions of dollars that we are going to be spending on government subsistence? And that's aside from the crime issues and the COVID issues.
Yeah, on just about every front, illegal immigration to this country, which basically comes two predominant ways. One is the one we always talk about, and that's the porous southern border. The other is with overstayed visas. We're one of the few countries in the world where you can arrive here on a 180-day visa, and on the 181st day, no one's really knocking on your door asking you to leave. But you know, and we've been victimized on this debate by a lot of sort of glowing rhetoric as it relates to immigration, much of it, almost all of it, false and wrong, and very few statistics on which public policy should really be based. Fundamental facts, many of which are inconvenient to the left's position that open borders and free-flowing immigration in this country are not a threat. There was a study was conducted by the National Academies of Sciences a few years ago that looked at the cost of immigrants, illegal immigration, and had shown that the drain on the country was hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Completely contradicting the position that Democrats and progressives would have you believe, that these individuals are coming and they're making immediate contributions. They're overwhelming the public welfare systems, the state Medicaid systems, the food dependency or food stamp systems, public schools. Importantly, we don't talk about this enough, are having to enormously restructure to accommodate for individuals who don't speak the language, so they're coming in, assume they're in, fifth, sixth grade, and they have zero English skills. Well, now all of a sudden you're having to kind of segment your schools, provide remedial English training. That's been enormously disruptive to a public education in this country. The highways, the emergency rooms, the hospitals, all over, burdened by this.
I can speak to the criminal justice issues, because just in the state of California, and I'm an escapee from California to Texas, thank God, but 47% of all of our inmates in the state of California incarcerated and imprisoned are illegal aliens. When you take a look at that inordinate number in comparison to population size of illegal immigration, it's absolutely astounding. And I think the American public doesn't understand, here's a component that they don't understand. The Immigration Reform Law Institute recently found that there was over 1.7 million illegal aliens from Central America and Mexico living in the United States that have been ordered to be removed pending the final order. So they've been ordered to be deported. And I think all of that is going to come to a screeching halt.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of work with the Remembrance Project and a good number of other organizations of so-called angel moms, angel dads, whose kids have been killed or victimized by illegal alien crime. And, we've gotten into this argument with the open borders crowd over whether there is a larger percentage of illegal alien crime or U.S. citizen crime. And of course, illegal alien crime is considerably worse, but it's almost
as if it, you know, I recently concluded that that debate is almost beside the point, because one life lost, when you really ponder it, if you look at it from a personal dimension, if it's your loved one, by a person who had no legal right to be here in the first place, is too many. So we have, you know, an extraordinary number of these cases of individuals, many young people who you might call dreamers themselves, is one of the arguments I've made. These are kids who also had dreams that were suffocated by the fact that we, for political and economic purposes, powerful elite in this country had decided they did not care to enforce what has been the federal laws and state laws of this country adopted by the citizens and the legal residents of this country.
You know, it's interesting. And I think one of the things that, that people don't understand in the United States, and that's because our media basically blinds people here. But my wife, Linda, who's my co-host on Talking While Married, and I have lived part-time in Mexico, in Puerto Vallarta, for 15 years. I speak the language fluently. Before I was in law enforcement, I was a teacher and an ESL teacher, English as a second language teacher, worked in migrant schools, taught illegal aliens that were in this country in an agricultural area. And so we're very much in tune with the people and the culture of Mexico. What the people of the United States don't understand, because they've been misled, is that number one, Mexicans by and large support the wall. They support the wall. And by and large, Mexicans of all socioeconomic strata supported President Trump when he was our leader. And a couple of the reasons for that is that they understand, and the Mexican government, for instance, wishes to God that they had a southern border wall to keep immigrants from Central America of coming, you know, from coming up into Mexico. Because what it does is it destabilizes the country. Number one, the security right. forces, and you see this right now, there's a huge destabilization of Guatemala, which is directly south of Mexico, and then Honduras, which is south and east of Guatemala. But just those three countries alone, the security forces have to basically monitor and walk with these migrants and through from country to country, and a lot of them stay, and then they take jobs from the people in those countries, which destabilizes the country. And then when they come up through the Mexican border and they're actually at the border between Mexico and the United States, they are the multitudes of homeless. And so the Mexican government has to provide for them and exhaust their social services and their resources and their economic and security resources to take care of these people. What Trump did is worked out a deal with President Obrador to have the Mexicans house, when we stop doing catch and release, to house them and shelter them in Mexico. And we subsidized that government so they would not come back across our border. And right. he worked out a deal where they used something like just a little bit under 30,000 security forces from Mexico to keep the Mexicans and to keep the San Salvadorians and the Hondurans and the people from other Central American countries right. on that side of the border. And now
a few things on that. I mean, that was called the stay in Mexico policy.
Exactly.
It was a great diplomatic accomplishment of the Trump administration. And most importantly, it was working, meaning, you know, these illegal border crossings were diminishing. The burdens of crime, of drugs, of sexual trafficking and other offenses were diminishing. And of course, that's been ended by Biden's initiative, one of over a dozen executive orders that have an immigration theme to them. And you know, the other important point is that you know, we need to kind of address in realistic terms who these people are, meaning we do have an amnesty program in this country for individuals who are fleeing country-specific, tangible threats Correct. And violence. These individuals are not
in that category by and large. Firstly, and let me just explain why. Firstly, under that policy, you're to seek amnesty in the country of first contact. So any Central American immigrant, if you were in Guatemala, you know, you could go to another Central American country, could go to Mexico. You would not leap over multiple countries to come to the United States. The reason they're leaping over multiple countries to come to the United States, of course, is because of the welfare and economic advantages that I think the world is aware of residing here. It's the greatest country in the world to be in. But under the amnesty policy, which they are seeking, which they will show up in immigration courts to pursue, is very specific from the standpoint of how that process is to be approached. So while the stay in Mexico policy was a great accomplishment and a great sign of U.S.-Mexican relationships, which we were warned would deteriorate considerably on Trump's watch, but actually, in my view, were probably more productive in the last 4 years than they were in the previous 40.
Restructuring
of NAFTA was immensely complex and constructive for the United States. That required a great degree. And that wasn't just head of state cooperation. It required, you know, a legislative passage in Mexico City. And we got that done. And then the stay in Mexico policy really stopped the bleeding as it related to the dangers and costs of people fleeing into this country who we don't know and who haven't been invited to be here. So I think, you know, the logical, in the ideal world, the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala is also important, and a wall structure there would be very convenient. What's not being really widely discussed, though, is that this current wave of immigration, unlike prior caravans that we can recall from the Obama administration, were not that Trump by and large stopped with all these policies. I mean, you didn't see these over the last 4 years, which was to the credit of the good work that they did. They're now starting up again, and they're organized. This is a business. It is a for-profit undertaking, and almost all of it is negative. A considerable part of it is drug-related. A considerable part of it is human trafficking.
You know, let me step in for a second, because those are issues that I have to deal with in my job. And so the drugs with the fentanyl and the methamphetamine, right, are at such levels that we have never seen this before in the United States. We have not only the MS-13, but recently we found through the Border Patrol interdicted over 22 people from Middle Eastern countries, primarily Syria, who are on the watch list, the terrorist watch list. We have, especially in Texas, through what we call the 35 corridor that goes right down from the border all the way up into Central and North Texas. We have the huge issue of sex trafficking, of human trafficking, and of sexual exploitation of minors. And associated with that, and I'm not too far from San Antonio, get there very quickly, just this last July, and I think there was a national story on this, we had a tractor-trailer rig that was interdicted, and we had 10 dead illegal aliens in that tractor-trailer rig. All these people are trafficked by the cartels, and now, for the first time ever, Michael, they are making just as much, if not more, money on trafficking people than they are trafficking drugs. So we have the death of immigrants coming across these borders, small children, sexual exploitation, sex trafficking, you know, gangs and drugs, and it's just atrocious.
So that's the ultimate irony, in my view, is that the way this is being presented, as you pointed out, in media, the way it's presented very commonly by globalists and progressives, that there's some sort of humanitarian component in leaving these borders open. The exact opposite is the case. Securing the border and regulating that migration is a humanitarian component, because you're able to weed out the drugs, the human trafficking, the for-profit malicious behavior
that has been, that is now so central to what's going on. And it shouldn't surprise anyone that some criminal syndicate involved in human trafficking or in significant drug dealing would treat these migrants abusively, which they have done. And when Trump pointed out that was somehow an uncomfortable reality or an uncomfortable fact, if you can recall, to the debate, but it's indisputably true. And it will be more true in this wave of immigration than it was in the last, because this one is more organized by large, well-funded, well-capitalized, for-profit traffickers who wish nothing but bad things, really, for both the country and for the people they're moving.
Yeah, what we're finding out in Texas is that we're seeing immigrants come across with wristbands on, and the wristbands are of different colors, and what they designate is how much money that person has paid to come across the border and who is protected, because they're not only do they pay money to come across the border, but they also pay protection money so that they won't be sexually exploited, they won't be hurt, they won't be raped, they won't be robbed, you know, things like that. And then, you know, the thing that really bothers me especially is the unaccompanied minors, because if you go back to what the Biden administration's spin is, and also from the what I call the Obamaists, is that, you know, the kids lived in cages and we've torn children apart from their parents. But the reality is the parents on the other side of the borders in these different countries have given their children up to complete strangers, to coyotes, to human traffickers, and have paid those people to take these children across the border. So,
or they've been abducted.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, the recent statistics in El Paso, we have a 96% increase of unaccompanied minors coming across the border. In Del Rio, not too far from here, 122%, and in Big Bend, all border areas, 141%. These are absolutely incredible statistics.
Right, and they're being accompanied by a well-trafficked, developed path that is immensely dangerous. There's deaths in every one of these caravans of individuals who don't make it through these areas. They're either victimized by murder, crime, rape, or issues of starvation and dehydration. It's an incredibly dangerous path. And we almost need to cease looking at these individuals and particularly the unaccompanied minors, as individuals who made any independent choice to take that course. They didn't. No 7-year-old wakes up in San Salvador and decides that morning that they're going to make an extraordinary journey through multiple countries over a series of weeks to walk to the United States. Someone makes that decision for them. And as you pointed out, it's either a parent who's profited in the most evil ways by almost selling the child, or it's a abduction. And let's just take the abductions. If your kid had been abducted and had been trafficked here, the first thing you would want would be their return, notification and return, not some process that's designed to assimilate them into American society with new family structures and things of that nature that don't exist, or, you know, put into long-term housing. That's not what you would seek if you were a Central American who had lost their child.
No, it's absolutely right. And this is compounded by the sanctuary cities that we have all the way across the United States that obstruct, the federal government from, you know, doing their jobs in trying to protect all of us. And so those investigations are thwarted. And we see ever increasing numbers of illegal aliens, like you said, 10% of which, at least so far they've found, are infected with COVID.
And you cited the California crime statistics. The federal statistics are extraordinary, considerably into double digits of percentages of federal inmates that didn't belong here in the first place. And behind each one of those inmates is a pattern of criminal
activity and criminal abuse and real life American victims. And, studies that had shown that these criminal illegal aliens had often committed 4 or 5 multiple crimes really before they had ended up being incarcerated, in part because of lenient sentencing, in part because of not, you know, having an aggressive ICE deportation policy historically. All of it politics and business, really, at the end of the day, and a complete neglect of this forgotten man and woman who was reasonably well represented by Trump and now has no voice in the room on any of these policy matters. And we need to be listening once again to these angel moms about the stories of their lost ones and, you know, looking objectively at the cost of this policy, because our obligation is to U.S. citizens, to the American people, not to some sort of design that's been put together by criminal syndicates and maybe complicit with foreign governments, maybe not, but all designed, you know, without the American people in mind.
Yeah. And what compounds that and what makes it hard for people like me that are forensic investigators and researchers in this particular area is the fact that the Biden administration, just like the Obama administration before it, they throw a blanket over the ability for us to get true data with regards to how many illegal aliens that we have in our criminal justice system, how many people we arrest, because what they've done at the state and local level and at the federal level is they have removed the boxes in our UCR, our Uniform Crime Report, which is our statistics to the FBI and DOJ, that identify illegal aliens. There are actual laws in many states, such as, you know, California, where you can't even ask the nationality or the status of the individual that you arrest and incarcerate. There's no place there. You're not allowed to ask the information, nor are you allowed to document it anywhere. So, you know, what they're trying to do is keep a blanket on us so law enforcement and the American people have no idea of how illegal aliens and illegal immigration are impacting the United States. Listen, Michael, I've got to draw this show to a conclusion, but we would love to get you back on Viewpoint again and have a further discussion on just what is happening with this fiasco of an immigration process. This is Dr. Ron Martinelli sitting in for Malcolm Out Loud on Viewpoint this Sunday.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Now, never before in our history have we witnessed the level of hatred that is now being waged against our law enforcement. While anarchist groups create havoc and overwhelm our first responders, these same groups and their corporate supporters are calling for the police forces to be shrunk and defunded. What can you and I do to make a difference? How can we stand up for what is right and to show our support? That's what I'm going to tell you about this incredible new platform. It's called ShopToTheRight.com. And it's a new shopping platform that will help you find businesses that align with your values. They feature products made in America. They support veteran-owned businesses as well as our law enforcement community. This is a time when we need to stick together, we need to shop together, and we need to support each other. It's time for you and I to make some noise and stand up to protect our country. And one easy way to do that is to shop and give our money to companies that don't seek to destroy our way of life. So join the fight for liberty. ShopToTheRight.com. Support those American businesses that support law enforcement and veterans.
My fellow Americans, this is Malcolm Out Loud. You know, a few years back, I was in corporate boardrooms offering counsel to business executives worldwide. It was important and demanding work, but out of the corner of my eye, maybe like you, I was watching some dangerous trends in our nation. Marxist teachers and professors brainwashing our children. A media that was not just biased, but complicit and overtly partisan, an offshoot of the Democrat Party even, and the progressive culture that was shutting down even violently any voices that challenge these radical ideas and tactics. Well, AmericaOutloud.com was born at that very moment. Well, it was a challenge I could no longer ignore, and I joined forces with some of the nation's most influential voices to bring you the real news and discussions that Americans need to hear at this crucial crossroads in American history. It is a fight for the soul of humanity. America Out Loud Talk Radio is the voice of liberty and justice for all.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@AmericaOutloud.com.
Well, welcome back to our next segment on Viewpoint this Sunday. I'm forensic criminologist Dr. Ron Martinelli, sitting in for Malcolm Out Loud. What is going on with the weaponization of race as a pushback position for what increasingly appears to be most everything today in America? You know, it just appears that a certain segment of people in this country are fixated on race and what they refer to as systemic racism in nearly every segment of American society. You know, they see life and society through the prism of color of one's skin rather than the content of their character, as I steal a quote from civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King, who I think is turning over in his grave right now as he looks down upon us and sees how this great nation has begun to degrade directly due to this new generation of racophobes. You know, joining me today is longtime friend and professional colleague Bruce, who's a retired command staff level law enforcement officer, one of the nation's most recognized law enforcement agencies in a major city. Welcome to the show, Bruce. How are you doing?
Thank you, Ron. Thank you for having me. I'm doing great. After 30 plus years in law enforcement and retiring, I'm living a great life. But like you, as you just stated, I wake up each morning and I read the newspaper and I see what's going on the television, what's making the headlines. And like you, I think about, what the heck is going on? It's really, really an attack on a society. It's attacked on America way of life. It's an attack on many generations and many sacrifices of Americans, both black and white and others. It's just really in a mode of just changing day-to-day life in America, moving in a different direction.
Well, you and I go back quite a while, okay, in law enforcement.
Yes,
coming out of the civil rights period, and we were in that era right after Martin Luther King and Malcolm Evers and, all these famous civil rights people. And that's when we started, our career in law enforcement. And I'm telling you what, did you ever think, Bruce, that we would be in the position that we are today, you as a black man and me as a white man, and going through this?
Ron, great question. And let me say this. The racism that we see and hear today in our media far exceeds anything from the 1950s. I mean, you wake up now in the morning and you listen to the news or read something in the newspaper and you think we're living back in 1955. Now, granted, there were many, many issues dealing with race and racism in the United States many, many years ago, but there's no way that anyone can compare that with what's going on today. You mentioned Medgar Evers, tragic incidents of racism in our country. And we all have paid a price for that, but we all have made great strides in improving the quality of life for people of generations, for our offspring, our kids. Things are not the same as it was in 1950, although you have a lot of people in position of power that would want to make minorities and people of color, make them feel and think that things are bad for you. And you know, the word that I use a lot, Ron, is victimization. People that are in power want me to be a victim of crime, want me to be just a victim. And as a law enforcement professional who responded to many, many 911 calls, and those people were victims, you know, when we respond to those type of calls, we know that they are in need. We know that they are needing help. We know that they need assistance. They are a victim. Well, that's what the culture is trying to make it seem like today, that, hey, Bruce, because of the color of your skin, you are a victim. So you are in need of assistance. You are in need of help. Let me help you. Let me lead you the way. Let me lead you down this path because you are a victim.
Well, I'll tell you, I listen to these leaders, all right? And I mean, Kamala Harris being one of them, and people like that, people of color, and they are saying in today's society that they have to have a sit down with their kids and basically scare them about police officers and, you know, watch out if you get stopped and make sure you do this and make sure you do that, because they're all out to get you. And there's so much racism out there. And I'm telling you what, I don't see it. And with my black friends, whether they're in law enforcement or they're ranchers or they're people living in my community, which is a racially mixed community, I'm not running into people that see this prism where everything is judged by color. Every single segment, education is judged by color. For God's sakes, they politicized the pandemic and entered the racial component into the pandemic, for God's sakes.
Yeah. And I see that too, Ron. And you're absolutely right about the pandemic. You have a culture that will utilize just about anything to turn it into a racist issue, to make more and more victims. The pandemic in and of itself is what we're dealing with right now today. You know, the vaccines are out now. Thank God that the vaccines are out and people are getting vaccinated. But when those vaccines were first made available, well, then there goes that culture that is saying, well, black folks are being victimized because they aren't getting the vaccines in their neighborhood. Black folks aren't allowed to participate in the vaccines as other communities are participating in. Communities of color, and there's just always a title that's just put on black folks as being victimized, and the pandemic, you know, being one of them.
No, you know, I absolutely agree. Take a look at both of us being in law enforcement, take a look at the Atlanta massage parlor killings that just took place. And I personally trained the undercover decoy prostitution and street crimes team. I developed that team for the Atlanta Police Department. And, you know, so you've got, you know, this crazy white man. And that's what he is. He's absolutely got serious mental health issues. He's a ticking time bomb, and he's fixated on sex and sexual addiction. Right. I'm not going to mention his name because I don't do that with mass murderers. But anyway, he goes to massage parlors, and he shoots and kills 8 people, of which the majority were Asian people. You're in a massage parlor. You know, you have a lot of Asians working in massage parlors, but you also have people of other colors there, white people. You've got, you know, got Hispanics. So 3 of the people, 2 women and 1 man are not Asian, right? So you got 2 women that are white and 1 guy that was killed, and he's Hispanic. And even though this man confessed to detectives and said that race had nothing to do with it, it was a temptation that he wanted to eliminate, which was a sexual addiction. And they believe that he had visited these places before. So, of course, that's the focus of his anger and his rage. He tells everybody, he tells the detectives, this had nothing to do with race. And when the poor captain from Atlanta PD, the PIO, public information officer, is telling the media what really happened, they are pursuing continuously this race angle, this Asian hate race racism.
Right, because it gives them a platform to tie every incident to race. It gives them a platform. This is a very recent incident. I followed this incident since it occurred. And you described the individual right. He's a nutcase. He's a sexual predator. He has sexual mental issues. And he has an infatuation of Asian women in his sexual fantasies. And that's what his problem is. He just has a fantasy over sexual women. Something tipped him off. Something finally clicked in his brain for him to go after Asian women. And that's what he was doing. He was going after what he desires in a violent mode, in a very violent manner, to where he shot these Asian sex workers is what occurred, in my opinion. Now, if he was a described racist against Asians, if that's what his motivation was, well, I'm just a predator against Asian people, more than likely he would have went to Chinatown and did what he did. But he chose the massage parlors because those are the places where he frequented for his sexual fantasies.
You know, I agree with you 100%. And it just seems, you know, you and I haven't been on the job for a while. That just seems too common sense for most people. But that is actually the answer. And when you've got the guy who is the perpetrator of these heinous crimes telling you exactly what his motivation is, and yet you get pushback from the media, and they're trying to cancel out this captain who is merely the messenger boy, right? He's trying to tell you.
Right.
That's his job. He's trying to tell you
as far as the media is concerned, it doesn't fit the narrative. There has to be a race tie to it. So even though you have officials from the law enforcement agency telling you what occurred, the media will do its own twist and its own spin to make it fit its narrative. And it's shameful. It really is shameful because it does no one any good.
I'm very happy that this captain didn't back down, but the narrative now from the police department is, you know, because they're, you know, they get hit in the face a couple of times. So now what they're saying is, we're looking at all angles. Well, yeah. but guess what? None of those other angles matter. It's only what the suspect tells us. That's what matters.
Right. You're exactly right. It's his statement. It's the evidence. But, you know, the police department and any agency, they have to look at the entire angles. They have to look at all avenues. But everything points back to what his motivations are. What are his motives? The guy's a sexual predator. He's a nutcase. Those are his own statements that, you know, it's got nothing to do with race. It's got to do with his sickness involving the sex workers.
Well, you know, moving on to a related topic. And, I wrote that best-selling book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police.
I read that book.
Which, by the way, was canceled. Okay.
Of course.
So Jeff Bezos, you know, CEO of Amazon, when he declared his public and financial support for the Black Lives Matter movement, he takes my book off the shelf, but we're still selling it.
Right.
But listen, so the false narratives going back to Michael Brown, hands up, don't shoot, that never happened, is that police officers kill an inordinate number of black men. Totally a false narrative.
Right. You know, in this society that we live in today, you would think that law enforcement officers don't come in contact, use of deadly force with folks that look like you, Ron. You would think it doesn't happen, but it does happen. And it does happen with black folks. But when it happens with black folks, it becomes a different story. Race is always used to further excite and inflame the story, to excite a community. Now, there's been a lot of tragic incidents involving the use of force and the death of black suspects. But you cannot put all these incidents into one barrel and say, well, you know, here they all are. You have to pick them apart. And, you know, that's the role of an investigation. Floyd, awful, terrible situation. Didn't involve the use of deadly force, but involved the death with the officer kneeling on Floyd's neck for 8+ minutes. Very tragic incident. But, you know, other incidents of police use of force, you know, someone, the one that you quoted in your book being, you know, hands up, don't shoot. You did a very extensive investigation into that that incident. That incident really inflamed the community. There was a lot of talk about him being shot in the back, and, you know, that he was about to surrender. And, you know, the whole movement of hands up, don't shoot came out of that situation.
You know, Bruce, that they still have T-shirts that people wear at BLM rallies and protests that say hands up, don't shoot. And then you see the crowd raising their hands and yelling hands up, don't shoot. And it never happened.
Well, the facts don't matter. It's the narrative that leads. It's the narrative. It's always the narrative. The facts really don't matter. You know, even in the case where you have witnesses that say, you know what, I was there, I saw what happened. That's really, really not the way it went down that the media puts together in order to, you know, sell newspapers or to make a news broadcast to inflame a community. And I think it's really a tragedy that the media has that power that it does, and it really does over a community and over an audience way of thinking it of an influence.
You know what's interesting about this whole thing, and it's downright scary for guys like you and me, you know, who have been out there for so many years trying to protect the public, and that is how people have increasingly, and we get this from our politicians. You know, I like to think of politicians as our dysfunctional parents, and whatever they do, you know, the crowds will mimic. And so when the politicians speak irreverently about law enforcement, they speak about defunding law enforcement. They call law enforcement officers murderers who have been in proven justifiable officer involved shootings. That just sends us as a nation into a tailspin. And I'm just trying to figure out where our future lies once they have now weaponized race.
Right, right. It's horrific. You used a comment about defunding the police, and I just want to just comment on that one. You defund any governmental agency, the police or social services, housing authority, the folks that you are hurting are Black folk primarily. People of color is what you're hurting. Defunding the police and a lot of major cities right now around the country, the police departments are hurting, fighting crime. With limited budgets, fighting crime with limited personnel. You know, one of the major cities that was recently in the newspaper, Portland, Oregon, regarding asking for additional funding from the federal government so that they're able to get more officers on the department, train more officers on the department, because their homicide rate, I think it tripled over the last year.
That's exactly right.
And it's because of a lack of responding, because of a lack of response to crime. You have a lot of officers now that used to be very proactive in communities that have taken the approach, well, you know, I won't respond, I won't initiate anything unless I'm dispatched to it.
Yep.
A few years ago, we were talking about profiling, you know, individuals being profiled. Ron, you and I worked in law enforcement many years. Profiling, in my opinion, is an invaluable tool in law enforcement. And I'll use the example. You're in your home, your nice suburban neighborhood. My neighborhood, at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and there's some individual that's parked out in a car in front of my house. I would hope an officer who drove by and witnessed that would take the initiative to stop and investigate, you know, why are you here at this hour in this neighborhood? What is going on? Now, it could be an Uber driver that I called, or it could be someone who's watching out because his partner just broke into a house next door. Could be either one of those scenarios. But the only way you're going to find out from that is for an officer to be proactive and take the initiative to do that. But when that occurs, when that officer gets out of the car and approaches that suspicious vehicle in the neighborhood at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and if it's a person of color in that vehicle, oftentimes it's, you know, it's harassment, it's profiling, you doing this because I'm Black. I mean, we hear it all the time. And a lot of times if it's a very innocent issue where it is that Uber driver out there, well, it's very easy to explain. And in most cases, the officer says, hey, just have to check it out. See you later. Have a good evening. However, if it's your flip side of that, and it is that guy that's watching out for the burglary suspect who's just broken in someone's home next door, well, I would think most people want that officer to be proactive in that type of an environment.
No, you know, you're exactly right. But of course, they don't have the training. They don't have the experience that law enforcement officers have.
Right.
So
right.
Rather than behavior, see, when I look at profiling, and, you know, you and I have made a lot of arrests, Bruce, and we didn't profile because it was a racial issue. We profiled behavior.
What because of the behavior and the circumstances.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right.
Exactly.
Right.
But it's so hard to get the public to focus on that. You know, it's like, you know, right. I'm driving while Black. No, that's not why I pulled you over. I pulled you over because you were speeding and you blew that stop sign.
Right.
Or
and a lot of times officers will confront that statement. You stop because I'm Black. And then here it is. It's midnight and you can't see inside of the vehicle anyway.
Well, but
you know, the violator still, you know, uses that as a weapon because it works. It's going to put a white officer more so nowadays on the defense.
Well, you know, let's follow that line for a couple of minutes, Bruce, with regards to defunding. And you mentioned Portland, and I used to be the police practices expert for the city of Portland. Mm-hmm. And I left that position when Mayor Ted Wheeler came in because I knew all about his background and it was not going to bode well for law enforcement. So now they have seen 1,000% increase in shootings and a huge increase in homicides. And, you know, and that's besides the riots and the burning of buildings and the courthouse, you know, the federal courthouse problems and everything like that.
Right.
Officers are not wanting to come to the city of Portland to work, and their crime rate is through the roof. I believe they said it was a 50-year high in crime. What bodes for the future?
Yep, exactly. It's really horrible when you think of the circumstances. And I'll tell you, Ron, you have to put it back on the residents of that community. At some point in time, people, you have to say enough is enough. We're taking back our community. We're taking back our city, and we're supporting our police department. It's ridiculous of what's going on around the country. Look at Seattle back during the summer months. I mean, there were whole communities in Seattle that the police wouldn't go into or were prevented from going into from their own city government, from their own mayor and their own city council people. No, just let them have it. What about the people that live in those communities? What about the businesses in that community? But back to Portland, you're exactly right, Ron. Now they're looking for funding. They're looking for officers who want to work in that community. The officers who are there don't want to work there, a large majority of them, because they don't get the backing and support from their city officials. So why take the initiative? Why put yourself out there on the line and be subject to, you know, being on the front page of the newspaper because you were proactive in law enforcement?
You know,
your officers don't want to do that.
Yeah, you know, you're 100% right. And you could speak to this issue far better than I, Bruce. But, you know, the vast majority of the Black community is very supportive of law enforcement for the reasons that you just stated. They are the people that feel the crime first. Okay.
Yep, exactly. They,
right. I mean, let's be honest about it. They feel the crime first in their neighborhoods, and they're literally hostages in their own homes, while at the same time, law enforcement is being defunded. And then nobody wants to come and work in these towns like Minneapolis, like Seattle, like Portland.
Yeah.
You know, and cities like that. Well,
yep. Yeah.
You know, I've got to tell you that we have to stop weaponizing race. But I want to piggyback on your statement when we first mm-hmm. started this segment, and that is stopping this weaponization of race comes first from the community. The community has got to get engaged, and they have to make this stop.
Yeah, they do, and they have to see it from politicians, from the media, the movies. Folks just have to see it and have to recognize it for what it is. It's, you know, someone else taking advantage of someone else and just using it as a way for a platform. You know, and back to the incident regarding the Atlanta shooting just a few days ago, we have politicians, the first thing they harp on is race, 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 race. Well, you know, the victims were Asian, shot by a white guy. That's what the facts are. But where's the factual about it being a racial incident? It's almost now, if you have a black guy getting arrested by a white cop, there's a racial element to it. And it's not.
This is Dr. Ron Martinelli with my guest today, Bruce, a longtime law enforcement officer and command staff level. We are talking about the weaponization of race in the United States, and it clearly needs to stop. This is Dr. Ron Martinelli sitting in for Malcolm Out Loud. Thanks for joining us today on another interesting segment of Viewpoint This Sunday.